Hello, welcome to the second part in our Heroes and Villains, what's it called?
Podcast,
meaning doublet. Is that the word?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, is that a trilogy? Doublet?
I think, let's go with that.
Yeah, okay.
We've got another live show coming up, just for you, those of you that are near London. On the 4th of December, we've got Are You Sitting Comfortably Ghosts at our usual venue, Toynbee Studios. You can find details of that. On our Facebook page is White Rabbit or Eyes Uncomfortably.
What date is that, Bernadette?
The 4th of December.
What time?
7:30.
Brilliant.
And more coming up next year, which we'll let you know about later on. But without further ado...
Here is the first story. This first story is called Hero and Villain, and it's by Paul Golden. He landed on the roof of the police headquarters with a thud that seemed heavier more potent than his actual weight. He had come. He had seen the signal in the sky, and now he was to answer the call and serve the city in his own special way. But Commissioner Gordon wasn't waiting for him. Behind the mask, the steely grey eyes narrowed, but then to his right there was a small cough. He flashed out a gauntleted hand and lifted the man in the shadows off his feet. He was not a small man, but the hero held him a foot in the air in one hand, seemingly with no effort.
"Who are you?" snarled Batman.
Simon Smythe, I'm from the DA's office,"
the man whimpered. At this, the lawyer was dropped to the floor. The lawyer rearranged his tie and bent down to get something out of the fallen briefcase.
"What do you want, lawyer?" snarled Batman.
Well, sir, on behalf of the City of Gotham and a collection of private individuals, I'm serving you with legal papers and various summonses to court."
At this, the lawyer held out a pile of papers 6 inches thick.
"What?" cried the masked avenger. "What papers?"
"Well, first of all, we have 23 counts of trespass and willful destruction of city property. And then there are over 300 traffic violations, including speeding in a built-up area, failure to stop at traffic lights, driving without due care and attention. And that's before we get to the fact that the city has no record of your driver license or vehicle registration."
"What?" cried Batman again.
"There's also a class action suit from 56 private citizens over destruction of their property."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, apparently you drove the Batmobile over, under and through their vehicles. They're all write-offs."
"This is ridiculous. Everything I did was in pursuit of a master criminal. If I hadn't acted then..."
But the lawyer interrupted him.
Would you be referring to Miss Oswald Cobblepot, a.k.a. the Penguin? Well... Mr. Cobblepot is also filing charges against you. Harassment, destruction of property, causing death, harm and distress to 2,000 of his pets."
"The Penguin's alive?"
asked Batman. "Well, to be honest, the bit where the Emperor Penguins took him into the water did leave it open for a sequel, wouldn't you say? Anyway, he's citing post-traumatic stress disorder for his actions. He says your constant harassment and failure to show compassion during the emotional time of him finding about his parents led to a mental breakdown."
Batman's shoulders slumped, but Smythe continued.
I also have a personal injury claim for Miss Selena Kyle, citing a napalm-like burn to the upper arm and two broken fingernails. Oh, and there's a restraining order on you regarding her. Neither of you are allowed within 4 blocks of each other if one or both of you are wearing latex. And there's more. The Joker is alleging you caused loss of business to his joke shop. Poison Ivy is alleging you broke a prenup agreement, and the Riddler, well, he submitted 5 claims, but we haven't managed to work out what they are yet.
Batman sneered.
"This will never stick, lawyer."
"Well, actually, we have a pretty good case, Mr. Wayne."
Batman's head snapped around.
"But how?"
"Mr. Wayne, you drive a 20-foot-long black car with wings and a jet engine at the back." "It wasn't difficult to trace."
Batman shook his head. This couldn't be happening.
"Mr. Wayne, we have an environmental protection officers at your manor as we speak, and also examining the area under your property. So far, they've found over 100 health and safety violations, including storage of noxious and explosive substances, unlicensed firearms, and more unregistered vehicles. And that's all before we start even looking at the contravention of most city building regulations caused by unsafe excavation to make the Batcave. Batman shook his head in disbelief. But there was more. The lawyer continued. There are also some more delicate matters covered in the papers. There's been a safeguarding alert raised against you. Apparently, social services are interested in why you have a frail 93-year-old man with comorbidities cooking and cleaning for you. Batman gulped.
What about Robin?
Yes, that has also raised some concerns. A bachelor in his 40s, living with a teenager who he calls the Boy Wonder. Let's just say they think it's worthy of further investigation. Suddenly, to his left, Batman heard a slight snigger and he whipped a small canister from his utility belt and threw it to the ground. Instantly, the whole area was bathed in a fierce white light, and in that light, he saw Robin with the Joker, Penguin and Commissioner Gordon all struggling to contain their laughter. The face below the mask blushed, and with a gauntleted hand, he slapped his forehead.
Oh, you guys.
Brilliant. That's by Paul Golden. That's called Hero and Villain.
And this next story is called Narky Jack, and it's by Michael Spring. The pirates are inconveniently situated for the harbour. And this spring, they've begun to let everyone know. The situation, when the wind from the mountains sweeps the scent of pines over their cabins, gets worse day by day. The pirates are restless. They need the salt tang of the sea. No one is sure what to do. Their swaggering is unnerving. Bars and supermarkets run out of rum. They spit at the feet of the townsfolk, most of whom are upstanding individuals, apart from, that is, Tess, the beautiful dark-haired prostitute who has a flat above the dry cleaners with ensuite facilities. The pirates, with their lack of seafaring adventure, seem to have an unnatural quotient in terms of desire. Tess's business is booming, and she thinks she might have to bring in help. There is talk of her taking over the lease of the dry cleaning shop below. Ron, the owner of the dry cleaners, is doing well too. The pirates, when visiting Tess, find it convenient to drop off their silken ruffs, nankeen trews and waistcoats heavy with embroidery to Ron. For payment of a substantial premium, Ron agrees to rush the cleaning through, ready to collect when they leave. Heaven forfend, though, that he should scratch a silver button or pull a silken thread. Tess is sporting more jewellery these days. She has very full breasts, and the low-cut gypsy tops she wears reveal much. Pearls, the size of plover's eggs, nestle snugly in her décolletage. She has a jewel in her navel the size of a musket ball. It sparkles when she laughs, and the soft brown skin of her belly ripples like the surface of a tropical inlet when a silent zephyr rustles the beachside palms. There is a heavy gold chain with what looks like a regal crest around one of her shapely ankles, and her long dark hair hangs in unrestrained, glistening ringlets, cascading over her shoulders like a bolt of silk. It is a dark, flowing mass. It is like sin. Someone suggests that she might be prosecuted. For what? Someone else asks. For having too good a time. The children of the town have taken to spitting, and, in imitation of the pirates, they swagger and they refuse to drink anything but rum, mixed with a little coke. It's true, but rum, nevertheless. They slap their thighs and guffaw when asked for homework assignments or to help with washing up. The local paper, the Argos, rails at the uncontrollable children. It blames the parents, but its anger is driven by a lack of advertising revenue. Both Tess and Ron have withdrawn their double column spaces, and the stores have stopped advertising their summer specials owing to the increased demand. The town council meets, and it's suggested that they send for Eric Bumpo. a noted gunslinger who has cleaned up more than one western town. When Eric's letter arrives, though, they find his terms are outrageous. He charges per bullet used as well as a retainer and an hourly rate. He has to have an indemnity against possible prosecution under health and safety legislation. Tess and the pirate captain, Narky Jack, are often to be seen together in profile at night at her window, behind the flimsy blinds and illuminated by the flickering scented candles with which Tess lights her room. A crowd gathers outside the dry cleaners on most evenings. They gasp when Narky Jack whips away her stays with a single stroke of his scimitar. Tess can be heard to sigh. It's a sigh that encompasses the history of the world. She sinks into his arms, and the expectant crowd applaud soberly. The council agrees that something must be done. Narky Jack finds unsigned notes from the townsfolk, enticing him and his crew to sea once more. They tell him of unarmed merchantmen carrying scrip, banknotes and bullion. They advise him that tankers bulging with crude are cruising less than a mile offshore. They offer handsome terms should the said vessel be surrendered up the coast where storage facilities are available. The letters give him notice of fast cutters carrying the source code of certain market-leading software products, which be worth a king's ransom in the Far East. Nothing moves him until, in June, he receives a note which says that the Daughters of Albion are on their summer cruise and giving a map reference where they can be found on the following Wednesday. The Daughters of Albion are young ladies from a college renowned for their skill in science. They are young, pure, and dedicated to the advancement of knowledge. Soon, the pirates are gathered. Buckles are polished. Blue, pink, and purple frock coats emerge, still in plastic from the dry cleaners, from mahogany wardrobes in the cabins where they are housed. Wooden legs are lacquered and screwed back into place. Parrots are brushed, and the pirates grease their pistols and the ends of their mustachios. No one eats garlic, or the cheeses mellowed from ewe's milk. They wash. The pirate vessel, the Flying Falcon, leaves harbour with all sail raised, gun ports open. Narky Jack waves a cursory farewell to Tess with his tricorn hat. But they both know that whatever it was that they had together is over. And things gradually return to normal. The children no longer take rum in their coke and get moaned at from here to breakfast time. Tess gets used to entertaining the town councillors and tradesmen once more, even though their ways are quieter and more restrained. Faking orgasms again becomes second nature to her. No longer is there talk of her hiring a mulatto to assist with the oral work. Ron's dry cleaning business carries on, unhindered by plaster shaking from the ceiling as it used to when Tess entertained Narky Jack. As for Narky Jack, he and his colleagues have retired to a large house in the Indies with the young ladies, where reputedly they have taken up golf. The Flying Falcon has been scuppered somewhere offshore, a playground for fish. That was Narky Jack by Michael Spring. Thank you very much for that great story.
This next story is by Robert Pallett, and it's called Tales of the Greek Heroes. Many gods and heroes are gathered up on Mount Olympus. It was a glorious day, and the sun was shining radiantly over all. Goddesses, gods, and heroes of all cultures have been welcomed to this extravaganza of a feast, laid out above the clouds on 1,000 tables, rich in hundreds of different tasty meats and vegetables. Amidst the plenty, everyone was having an exceptionally lovely time catching up with one another. They'd been invited there to celebrate the completion of Hercules' labours. The last of the many deliciously meaty and vegetable-based courses had been eaten, and from the head table, Hercules was given a dazzling speech detailing all his amazing labours. He made sure to pepper it with tangential anecdotes and was truly an entertaining oration, sleekly displaying one more of his many talents. Hercules had just finished his account of the final labour, which was the capture of Cerberus, the three-headed dog, with a serpent's tail and lion claws, who guarded the underworld. Riots of laughter echoed all around the clouds as he described how he convinced the hellhound to dress up in pantaloons and yelp, "I'm a little teapot, short and stout," in exchange for sausages. A wave of applause broke loose as he made his closing remarks. "What I have gone through, such a journey as that, has not only purged my crime of killing my own children, but has shown me what it is to be a man and a god at the same time. It is the courage to step up and take what is rightfully yours." And he turned around and spoke face to face with his father, Zeus. "Papa Zeus, you have ruled this land for hundreds upon thousands of years. We gods have all done well with your wise direction. But I put it to you that you are losing touch, and that the mortals which you reign over are learning new ways to challenge our authority. This I plead you, that it is time someone else had their charge, someone younger, someone who knew how to bring us and the mortals together and stronger." And the gods and goddesses looked around and saw traces of sympathy on each other's faces. Had the time had come for the son to justly challenge the throne of his father? Hercules' brows narrowed, and all of a sudden he threw back both arms while snapping his fingers and turning his head to his right-hand side. In an instant, all the folk bands dropped out of the clouds to their doom, and a rad glam rock band appeared on the central cloud stage, clad in angry leather and fabrics with challenging patterns. Hercules ripped off his toga to reveal an excellent fluorescent spandex suit with power shoulders and began to strut around the cloud and offer his pelvis everywhere as he laid down claim to his right to ascend as king of the gods. The synth bass blared and the loud drums boomed all over the heavens, and all the mortals below on earth couldn't help but funkily demand things too. Lo, everybody was up in the arms demanding better health care and education in a fit of raw 80s energy. And all the politicians woke up to find protesters in vivid colours dancing on top of their cars and bearing progressive placards. The young pretender Hercules jumped here and there amongst the gods, expressing through the medium of dance his message of frustrated youth energy. He pumped his fists and rocked his forearms alternatively, while thrusting his chest aggressively at Zeus to show that the passionate love in his heart was tragically bound by his father's power lust. But above the action, an unmoved Zeus sat majestically on his throne and watched it all with a cold, stony face. He let his son finish his prancing before rising from his seat majestically. He looked deep into Hercules with sickened eyes and boomed, "You dare to challenge my kingdom with those prissy moves?" And all of a sudden, his disgusted face became one of immense rage, and all the clouds in the world turned deep black and burst their seams. Zeus grew to 10 million times his size and put on a three-piece suit of rage and fire while throwing down billions of thunderbolts and meteors to reach everyone in the universe. Great towering walls of flames enveloped the earth below and scorched the land dry, while demons of the deep ripped up mountains and cities and pulverized them into dust. And at the same time, Zeus shrunk 1,000 times and divided into a gazillion replicas that leapt into everybody in the universe's minds as they lay there burning to death to break out extremely sick and heavy dance moves. All his muscles and sinews ripped apart the tune through a ferocious array of dark moves that were spellbinding in incredibleness. With mad red and black eyes, tyrannical Zeus fought his way towards any kindness or love that mortals held in his heart in order to destroy all that had been good once and for all. Hercules stood there in his lame spandex, stunned as Zeus entered his heart to rip it apart. Zeus kicked down the door to his son's erratic valve and let the blood stream out, while burning to a cinder all blood cells he could find. He was looking for the goodness in his son's heart that challenged his authority so. It was there somewhere, and he was determined to find it.
But Hercules knew that he could still muster the strength to overcome such tyranny. He was waiting in his own left ventricle, with all the objects of his labours, from the Nemean lion to the Lyrian hydra, the Cretan bull, and the cattle of Graon. As Zeus burst in, he saw what looked like Hercules' goodness at the end of the ventricle, all wrapped up in blood cells. He stormed towards it and plucked it from the wall, but it was an illusion. What Zeus had plucked wasn't at all his son's goodness, but actually the hydra, the lion, and the cattle squished up together. They had teamed up to create a super beast. And they ensnared Zeus in surprise and experimental multi-moves. And at the same time, the cattle and Hercules had snuck out the ventricle, where Hercules mounted the bull to stampede through his own arteries towards the lungs, navigated the maze of Avoli and Brocylus to find the windpipe. And there, Hercules leapt off the bull, climbed out of his own mouth, and was back in Mount Olympus again. It was then only a few strides to the music cloud, where he climbed with all his remaining strength to change the tune on the CD player. He breathed for just a moment, laying face into a cloud, before throwing his arms up in the air, wrapping a smile across his face and thrusting his pelvis once more into the fray. Yes, they were going to have a funky good time instead. Brilliant. Thank you very much. That was, of course, Robert Pallett, The Tales of the Greeks' Heroes.
This next story, is it the last story?
No.
Last but one story, penultimate story, is called Out of Time, and it's by Van der Mel. Finally, Dad, you can hold your head up. See my wetted blade. Here's my blooded footprint on the very street where yours once trod, where Grandfather trailed his famous horn and bought our future. It was all grand houses then, the minister's residences and the king's palace. Simpler times. A son would take his father's trade. A word was as good as a bond. A chance for fame, for glory, was a call to arms away. You could tell friends from enemies. It's just offices now. All hail King Commerce, the invader we welcomed with open arms. It's still the place most likely to be raided, still in need of protection. Yes, it had to be here. I've waited a long time for this battle. All my life, you might say. You know the old blah blah, some are born to greatness, whilst others have to try and swallow it whole. No one even bothers with those who had it snatched away. Where's my memorial? My day of flags and banners? It's all right for my father with his statue in the town square, his Piper's Day parade. Give me a tin whistle and 100 invading soldiers, I'll see them off. And Eradicus, my grandfather, he saved the whole peninsula from the hordes. 2,000 thumbs to win his heart's desire. What do I get? A name. Hero. The son of a hero. The son of a hero. 10 out of 10 for imagination, Dad. Why can't you just name me John? I don't know. Maybe you panicked. Maybe you saw the way things were going, the peace treaties, the politicians skimming the cream from the trade agreements, democracy breaking out like a fucking rash, everyone getting fatter and slower and richer, all that fire in the belly for conquest fizzling away. Better to name me hero than leave it to chance. Except you can't name a hero. Heroes are made. Forged in their search for the prize. Who believes it otherwise? Without the proof, it's just a name, and just a name before long becomes just a joke. And for me, the prize was Penelope. She never jeered or made signs. She'd just look at me with her big sad eyes and heal every bruise on my soul. And she asked me one day, after one of Fusty's classes, would you bring 2,000 thumbs for me?
20,000!
My voice all hot, wet breath, heart pumping to my fingertips, my eyes gazing into the deathless universe of her enlarged pupils. Really? Her knees pressed together, her hands clasped between clenched thighs, while her eyelashes semaphored desire. All innocence and possibility. We said we'd love each other forever, and you can trust a hero. When a hero says they're going to do something, you can be sure that's exactly what they're going to do. We're driven like that. So we were 12. Makes no difference. All I needed, all I prayed for, was those blessed stars to align. All I needed was my moment. I said I'd love her forever and I meant it. Every word, thumbs and all. And now it's the running and the screaming. Blood on the walls, the syrupy smell of it thick in the air. The feel of a good cold blade through flesh and bone. This is history, my friends. This is how we write the stories for future generations. My big moment. Here, at last. Remember me. You won't be able to forget. Another 10 minutes and I'll be over my work done. I'll be here by then. I can hear those sneering sirens. Nino, 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 like being back at school. Old Fusty McCluskey's modern history lessons, which to a fair extent was also my family's history. It was Fusty who started the thumbs up thing, sticking his digit up when I walked in, everybody laughing, every time. It didn't occur to me then, but Fusty would have been there, maybe even knew my grandfather, maybe even saw it all firsthand. Born of a long line of scribblers, no wonder it all felt so real when he first told the story. Farmer Eradicus, making moon eyes at the First Minister's daughter on market day all those years ago. But Daddy VIP won't give him the time of day. What's he going to do? Make up the bride price in spuds and cabbages? No. She's promised to the son of some rich bookworm, some university scholar, and that's that. But what's written in books and what's written in the stars doesn't always correspond. Cue the invasion. Eradicus tells the minister he'll prove himself in battle, declares himself devoted to the matchless rose, and though women don't generally get a voice of their own in history, it is noted that she liked the cut of his jib. All he asks is a sign of approval from the minister. The minister dons his elaborate breastplate and points his thumb at the floor. Eradicus couldn't even afford a helmet. What could a poor farmer do? Nothing. But Eradicus, he's got drive, ambition. He's focused, eyes on the prize. That's the thing about heroes, you see. And in those days, warriors were paid from the king's coffers for every enemy thumb they collected as proof of a kill. In front of the delighted king who promised Rose 2,000 thumbs for her hand in marriage. And the minister couldn't argue with that. Old Fusty doled out the details and we boys drank in the battle scars whilst the girls daydreamed about the strange power of an appropriately utilised thumb. I could never tell whether Fusty was being sarky or not. But when the jeering and the thumbs up signs took hold, I just smiled and walked on. Hero, hero, everywhere I went. Could have destroyed them all. But I didn't. Fakers, you see. Eyes on the prize. My sweet Penelope. Didn't matter because anything was possible. Just had to wait for my chance. Where is she now? Married. To a fucking policeman. To be fair, he's done well for himself. Evander. Captain of the financial district's elite force, still. Went to their wedding. Let's face it, if Penelope was my prize, then Evander was the challenge to be overcome, the villain. Bloody gap year volunteering, that's what did it. They got assigned together. I told her I had to train, had to hone my body and my mind for what was to come, had to be ready. No time for holding old lady's hands. In the evening we'd meet, and all she ever talked about was Evander this and Evander that. Lovely Evander, gentle Evander, helpful. Sly, more like. Slippery, deceitful, conniving, conspiring, little shit, Evander. I tried to tell her as gently as I could, really. But in the end it was like talking to a stone, and whatever other reason there is that makes boys swing their fists at each other's faces, rage or fear or pleasure even. It's really all about competition, testing themselves, finding their place in the world. I never saw a playground fight reach its natural end. More than the fact that no one was foolish enough to take me on, even fights between other boys would peter out in my presence. The onlookers' jeering would subside to a whisper until the scuffle of the combatants' own feet harried them to stillness, and they'd look at me and wonder why the hell they were bothering. I don't think it was that they thought of me as above them, but they thought of themselves as somehow beneath me. And what could I do with that? Even to challenge it would be to lose. It was exactly the same at their wedding. Couldn't touch him. I stood there looking at the happy couple, at the guests and the waiters and the band, all those ordinaries, while the horn players tooted at me from the stage. Hero, hero. I wasn't like them. I'd never been one of them. I looked up at the stars, watched them turning a great circle above us, and all at once I could see the lie. Fucking stars, my ass. Eradicus, Piper, every other hero in the history of the planet, they're all just blind, lucky bastards. Right place, right time, that's all. There's no plan, no greater power guiding our steps. No one's bought to it. Good God. I am one of them. And I'd already lost. I was so busy preparing for the battle, I didn't even notice it had started without me. What did I know about fighting, after all? I'd never had a fight in my life. And I looked down again, and there was old Fusty, sitting quietly at a table, watching me, his sarcastic stub of a thumb crooked in the air. There's no point waiting for your big opportunity. You want your chance to shine, make it happen. You want to be the hero. Just go out and do it. And now I can see the flashing blue lights edging the buildings. At last, the heroes arrived. The new breed. How cheap a word it is now. How quotidian. Uniform and a wage. A political angle to spin. Wouldn't know a real hero if they fell over one, but they're about to have their moment. Their chance for glory. Okay. Confession time. The thing is, Penny, I've had to include a fair few fingers to make up the 20,000. What could I do? There's just not that many people in this district. You know, it's all banks and insurance companies around here. Most of the offices are empty by this time, so I'm still a few short. But now the cavalry's finally here. What is it? 50 men in the elite force? That's 500 digits. Should see me nicely over the line. I wonder how your husband's going to cope with no fingers. Thank you very much, Vandermal. That was out of time. Fantastic.
So the last story is by Julie Ballou, and it's called The Lure of the Goat. It was March 1943. So far, William had effectively managed to avoid doing his bit for king and country. He ran a successful business manufacturing games for amusement arcades before the war, and was now dealing in properties in the north of England. Business he and his father felt sure would prosper once this dreaded war ended. His father had seen it happen before, after the last war. Homes fit for heroes, decreed a healthy and better environment away from the squalid inner cities. Whole new towns were developed, and the underground kept on extending way beyond the original plans. Now father and son would make the perfect entrepreneurial partnership building, not only homes for the future, but a family business. They would have a lasting legacy. But William knew his good war wouldn't last. It was only a matter of time before he was called up. His mate Gordon truly believed he'd been looked at by a guardian angel. He often said his late mum wouldn't see him slaughtered on a foreign battlefield or left to rot in a German prison camp. She would burst through the curtains of mortality and scoop him up in her arms for safety. But his old mum must have been at the bingo in heaven when his call-up papers arrived. And so he was sent off to do his duty. Gordon took a bullet to the heart 3 months later during the Battle of El Alamein. And now William hopes he too is playing bingo with his dear old mum in the great bingo hall in the sky. William was so concerned his call-up would happen any day now that he just couldn't bring himself to go home and spend the evening with his parents. To sit by his adoring mother in their cosy living room while she would gaze at him with the melancholy knowledge she couldn't protect him any longer. He was an only child, and his folks doted on him. What would become of them if anything happened to him? Their world would have no meaning. They would simply travel through the rest of their lives on autopilot, willing a quick demise with every footfall. William couldn't bear the thought. He even considered opting for conscientious objection, but he didn't have the nerve, and besides, his family would be scorned by neighbours and grieving parents of brave soldiers, so all that was left was to hope the bloody war would end before it was his turn, and watch his
Mother rushed to the door first thing every morning to sift through the purse, searching for the letter that would tear their little family apart. And witness the most religious relief she experienced each morning when it had not arrived. As he was in London on business, he decided rather than rush back for the evening family meal, he'd pop into a pub instead, grab a pale ale and bite, then get the late train back. His parents would most likely be in bed by the time he returned and wouldn't have to face them. He was about to go into the Prince of Wales, but remembered he once had a meal in the Goat in Kensington, and damn fine it was too, so the goat it was. And just as he was tucking into a plate of what they had deemed rabbit stew, a rather distinguished-looking chap with dark hair and a moustache noticed William. "Good Lord. Will McSwan, as I live and breathe."
"John? Oh, good heavens! Must be years since I saw you."
And that was how it all began. William and John had been childhood friends, and John had worked as a chauffeur for William, but that was years ago, and each had gone their separate ways, knowing little of one another. And after several pints and a dozen roll-ups between them, John had come up with a plan. "I'm an accountant with an engineering firm now. Good little earner, but nothing compared to what the investors make."
"Investors, you say? Well, that might interest my folks. Only the other day, Father was talking about investing in more property. He reckons when the war is over, people are still going to need somewhere to live."
"Indeed, indeed," said John.
The new old friends met up the next day in the family home, where John and Hopi was welcomed with open arms. Of course, John had little recognition of Mr. and Mrs. McSwan, but ensured them he had spent the intervening years thinking of them fondly.
What a lovely pair of evenings.
What a lovely pair of earrings, Mrs. McSwan. My, you do look years younger than your age.
I always wished I had a dad like you, Mr. McSwan. My old man never bothered with me."
And from then on, John was a regular visitor, a second son, Mrs. McSwan liked to remark as she poured him another cup of tea and straightened his tie.
So, when 7 months later, John confided in the couple that he had helped their devoted son William to go into hiding to avoid the dreaded call-up, they were extremely grateful. Mrs. McSwan pressed dainty kisses on his face, and Mr. McSwan reddened as he tried to keep his emotions to himself as he hugged William to his chest. But the story of William's safety could not be further from the truth. Yes, he would not be called up now, nor would he have to endure the travails of war. A dutiful death was not to be his. William's death was sordid and suspicious, with no evidence of gallantry. His old friend John needed him to disappear, so he simply hit him over the head with a mallet and, whilst unconscious, placed his body in a 40-gallon drum, then tipped consecrated the phoric acid over it. When William had turned to sludge, as it usually is the case when the human flesh meets the phoric acid, he was befittingly poured down a manhole. With the real son out of the way, room had been neatly made for the surrogate son, and John headed to the McSwan house to give an update. Everything went swimmingly. John spent cosy afternoons drinking tea and eating hot buttered crumpets with William's loving parents, delivering tidbits regarding his whereabouts and adventures. The pattern went unchallenged for 18 months, and by then even John began to think of himself as a McSwan. But then the war ended, and William's parents began to wonder where their beloved son could be. Why hadn't he returned to them? What on earth was he doing? Not one moment did they suspect what remained of him was lurking in the sewer behind John's workshop, and that certainly didn't enter their heads at all. However, after a couple of months, it was clear they were not going to be stopped asking annoying questions, so John came back one day to tell them they would all soon be reunited, as William was back and waiting for them at John's workshop. Excitedly, they jumped into the car and headed off to see their long-lost son. However, on entering the workshop, it was clear they had made a mistake. The first to die was Mr. McSwan, then his wife. By now, John had graduated to a shotgun, and the speed and certainty of such a weapon was much easier on his poor, bare hands. Strangulation can be so rough on the triceps and extensor flexors, not to mention that horrible moment when the victim looks straight in the perpetrator's eyes and pleads for clemency, knowing full well that they know, full well, one of you has gone too far to stop now. William's
bullet-ridden parents face the same fate. And in keeping with the family tradition, their bodies were also reduced to sludge after a good soaking in sulfuric acid, and they joined their boy down the manhole. Why did he do these terrible things? Well, for the same reason most people betray all that is moral and holy for money. For money. John stole the couple's pensions checks and sold their properties, earning him the equivalent of £300,000 in today's money. And now that John had a taste for it, he would not give up. On and on he went, killing and burning and hiding and earning, as he put it. By the time he was caught, John had acquired the nickname the Acid Bath Murderer, and the rest is history. He was caught after his last murder. An elderly widow fell for his stories and allowed herself to become a victim. However, she didn't go as easily as the others, and left behind a trail, 3 gallstones, and a part of a denture. So all in all, a body. When at last he was caught and tried and sentenced to hang, he came up with the idea of pleading insanity, which, considering his hobby, should really have been the ideal description of him. He claimed to have drunk the blood of his victim to satisfy his vampire lust, that old story, and even confessed to a childhood trauma that caused his rapid descent to villainy. He told everyone who listened that he was haunted with dreams of running through forests of crucifix which then turned to shadowy trees dripping and oozing blood. An evil spectre ran from tree to tree, crouching the deep crimson blood in the silver goblet, then chased after the young John, urging him to drink, drink, drink. And finally, he was caught and frozen to the spot, and made to stand put while the devil creature poured the blood cocktail down his throat. And sadly for John, the beak didn't buy his tail, and the villain of our story ended his days dangling from a rope with a broken neck. The Goat Pub still stands today, is often heaving on a weekend or payday, but be warned, if you ever pop in for a bevy, you never know who you might run into and what plan they may have for your destiny. Well, thank you very much. That's Julie Ballou with The Lure of the Goat. That's all the stories. Thank you very much in our Heroes and Villains special.
Thank you very much. I hope to see some of you at our Ice and Comfortably Ghosts on the 4th of December in Toynbee. And if not, we'll be back shortly.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.